voice. "Ragnac, my dear, is it true you have a woman inside?" She reached for her sword. Chapter 4. The abbot placed his hands on the head of the young albino kneeling before him and closed his eyes. He spoke mind to mind in the manner of the order. "Are you prepared?"
"How can I tell?" answered the albino.
"Release your mind to me," said the abbot. The young man relaxed his control. In his mind, the image of the abbot's kindly face overlapped his thoughts. His thoughts swam, interweaving with the memories of the older man. The abbot's powerful personality covered his own like a comforting blanket, and he slept. Release was painful, and his fears returned as the abbot woke him. Once again, he was servitor, and his thoughts were his own.
"Am I prepared?" he asked.
"You will be. The messenger comes."
"Is he worthy?"
"Judge for yourself. Follow me to Graven." Their spirits soared, entwined, high above the monastery, free as the winter wind. Below them lay the snow-covered fields at the edge of the forest. The abbot pulsed them onward, over the trees. In a clearing by a crofter's hut stood a group of men, facing a doorway in which stood a tall young man, and behind him a woman, sword in hand.
"Which is the messenger?"
asked the albino.
"Observe," answered the abbot.
Reynard had not had things going his way just recently. An attack on a caravan had been beaten off with heavy losses, and then three more of his men had been found dead at dusk, among them his brother, Erlik. A prisoner he had taken 2 days previously had died of fright long before the real entertainment could begin, and the weather had turned for the worse. Bad luck was haunting him, and he was at a loss to understand why. "Damn the speaker," he thought bitterly, as he led his men towards the cabin. If he had not been in one of his 3 days' sleeps, the attack on the caravan would have been avoided. Reynard had toyed with the idea of removing his feet as he slept, but good sense and greed had just held sway. Speaker was invaluable. He had come out of his trance as Reynard carried Erlik's body back to the camp. "Do you see what has happened while you slept?" Reynard had stormed.
"You lost 8 men in a bad raid, and a woman slew Erlik and another after they killed her horse," answered Speaker.
Reynard stared hard at the old man, peering at the sightless sockets. "A woman, you say?"
"Yes."
"There was a third man killed? What of him?"
"Slain by an arrow through the forehead."
"Who fired it?"
"The man called Ragnac, the wanderer who comes here on occasions."
Reynard shook his head. A woman brought him a goblet of mulled wine, and he sat on a large stone by a blazing fire. "It can't be. He wouldn't dare. Are you sure it was him?"
"It was him," said Speaker. "And now I must rest."
"Wait! Where are they now?"
"I shall find out," said the old man, returning to his hut.
Reynard called for food and summoned Grusin. The axeman squatted on the ground before him. "Did you hear?" he asked. "Yes, do you believe it?" answered Grusin. "It's ridiculous. But when has the old man been wrong? Am I getting old? When a craven like Rek can attack my men, I must be doing something wrong. I will have him roasted slowly over the fire for this." "We're getting short of food," said Grusin. "What?" "Short of food. It's been a long winter, and we needed that damn caravan." "There will be others. First we will find Rek. Is it worth it? Asked Grusin.
Worth it? He helped some woman to kill my brother. I want that woman staked out and enjoyed by all the men. I want the flesh cut from her body in tiny strips from her feet to her neck. And then the dogs can have her.
Whatever you say.
You don't sound very enthusiastic, said Reynard, hurling his now empty plate across the fire.
No.
Well, maybe I'm getting old. When we came here, there seemed to be a reason for it all. I'm beginning to forget what it was.
We came here because Abilene and his mangy crew had my farm sacked and my family killed, and I haven't forgotten. You're not turning soft, are you?
Grusin noted the gleam in Reynard's eyes. No, of course not. You're the leader, and whatever you say is fine by me. We will find Rek, and the woman. Why don't you get some rest?
A curse on rest, muttered Reynard. You sleep if you have to. We leave as soon as the old man gives us directions.
Grusin walked to his hut and hurled himself on his fern-filled bed.
You're troubled?
His woman, Mela, asked him as she kneeled by his side, offering him wine.
How would you like to leave?
He asked, placing a huge hand on her shoulder. She leaned forward and kissed him.
Wherever you go, I shall be with you, she said.
I'm tired of it, he said. Tired of the killing. He gets more senseless with every day. He must be mad. Hush, she whispered. Wary now.
She leaned in to his bearded face and whispered in his ear.
Don't voice your fears. We can leave quietly in the spring. Stay calm and do his bidding until then.
He nodded, smiled, and kissed her hair.
You're right, he said. Get some sleep.
She curled beside him, and he gathered the blanket around her.
I don't deserve you, he said, as her eyes closed.
Where had it gone wrong? When they were young and full of fire, Reynard's cruelty had been an occasional thing, a device to create a legend. Or so he had said. They would be a thorn in Abilene's side until they achieved justice. Now it was 10 years, 10 miserable, bloody years. And had the cause ever been just? Grusin hoped so.
Well, are you coming? Asked Reynard from the doorway. You're at the old cabin.
The march had been a long one and bitterly cold, but Reynard had scarcely felt it. Anger filled him with warmth, and the prospect of revenge fed his muscles so that the miles sped by. His mind filled with pictures of sweet violence and the music of screams. He would take the woman first and cut her with a heated knife. Arousal warmed his loins. And as for Rek, he knew what Rek's expression would be as he saw them arrive.
Terror. Mind-numbing, bowel-loosening terror.
But he was wrong. Rek had stalked from the hut, furious and trembling. The scorn on Virai's face was hard to bear. Only anger could blank it out, and even then, barely. He couldn't help what he was, could he? Some men are born to be heroes, others to be cowards. What right had she to judge him?
Regnak, my dear, is it true you have a woman inside?
Rek's eyes scanned the group. More than 20 men stood in a half-circle behind the tall, broad-shouldered outlaw leader. Beside him stood Grusin, the axe-man, huge and powerful, his double-headed axe in his hand.
"Morning, Rain," said Rek. "What brings you here?"
"I heard you had a warm bedmate, and I thought, good old Rek, he won't mind sharing." And I'd like to invite you to my camp. Where is she?
She's not for you, Rain, but I'll make a trade. There's a caravan headed...
Never mind the caravan, shouted Reynard. Just bring out the woman.
"'Spices, jewels, furs. It's a big one,' said Rick.
"'You can tell us about it as we march. Now I'm losing patience. Bring her out!'
Rick's anger blazed, and his sword snicked from its scabbard.
"'Come and get her, then, you bastards!'
Virai stepped from the doorway to stand beside him, blade in hand, as the outlaws drew their weapons and advanced.
"'Wait!'
ordered Reynard, lifting his hand. He stepped forward, forcing a smile.
"'Now listen to me, Rick. This is senseless. We've nothing against you. You've been a friend. Now, what's this woman to you? She killed my brother. So you see, it's a matter of personal honour. Put up your sword and you can ride away. But I want her alive.'
"'And you too,' he thought.
"'You want her? You take her,' said Rick. "'And me too. Come on, Rain. You still remember what a sword's for, don't you? Or will you do what you normally do and scuttle back into the trees while other men do your dying for you? Run, you dung worm!'
Rick leapt forward and Reynard backed away at speed and stumbled into Grusin.
"'Kill him, but not the woman,' he said. "'I want that woman!'
Grusin walked forward, his axe swinging at his side. Virai advanced to stand beside Rek. The axeman stopped 10 paces short of the pair, and his eyes met Rek's. There was no give there. He turned his gaze to the woman. Young, spirited, not beautiful, but a handsome lass.
"'What are you waiting for, you ox?'
screamed Reynard.
"'Take her!'
Grusin turned and walked back to the group. A sense of unreality gripped him. He saw himself again as a young man, saving for his first holding. He had a plough, which was his father's, and the neighbours were ready to help him build his home near the elm grove. What had he done with the years?
"'You traitor!'
shouted Reynard, dragging his sword into the air. Grusin parried the blow with ease.
"'Forget it, Rain. Let's go home.'
"'Kill him!'
Reynard ordered. The men looked at one another, some starting forward, while others hesitated.
"'You bastard! You treacherous filth!'
Reynard screamed, raising his sword once more. Grusin took a deep breath, gripped his axe in both hands, and smashed the sword into shards, the axe blade glancing from the shattered hilt and hammering into the outlaw leader's side. He fell to his knees, doubled over. Then Grusin stepped forward. The axe raised and chopped, and Reynard's head rolled to the snow. Grusin let the weapon fall, then walked back to Rick.
"'He wasn't always as you knew him,' he said.
"'Why?' asked Rick, lowering his blade. "'Why did you do it?'
"'Who knows? It wasn't just for you. Or her.' Maybe something inside me just had enough. Where was this caravan?
I was lying, lied Rick. Good. We will not meet again. I'm leaving, Graven.
Is she your woman?
No.
You could do worse.
Yes. Grusin turned and walked to the body, retrieving his axe.
"'We were friends for a long time,' he said. "'Too long.'
Without a backward glance, he led the group back into the forest.
"'I simply don't believe it,' said Rick. "'That was an absolute miracle.' "'Let's finish breakfast now,' said Virai. "'I'll brew some tea.'
Inside the hut, Rick began to tremble. He sat down, his sword clattering to the floor. "'What's the matter?' asked Virai.
"'It's just the cold,' he said, teeth chattering.
She knelt beside him, massaging his hands, saying nothing.
"'The tea will help,' she said. "'Did you bring any sugar?'
"'It's in my pack, wrapped in red paper. "'God heaven knows I have a sweet tooth. "'Cold doesn't usually get to me like this. "'Sorry.
"'It's all right. "'My father always says sweet tea is wonderful for... "'Cold.
"'I wonder how they found us,' he said.
Last night's snow must have covered our tracks. It's strange. I don't know. Here, drink this.
He sipped the tea, holding the leather-covered mug in both hands. Hot liquid splashed over his fingers. Virai busied herself clearing away and repacking his saddlebags. Then she raked the ashes in the hearth and laid a fire ready for the next traveller to use the hut.
"What are you doing at Drostelnok?"
Rek asked, the warm, sweet tea soothing him.
"I am Earl Delnar's daughter," she said. "I live there."
"Did he send you away because of the coming war?"
"No. I brought a message to Abilene, and now I've got a message for someone else. When I've delivered it, I'm going home. Are you feeling better?"
"Yes," said Rek. "Much better." He hesitated, holding her gaze.
"It wasn't just the cold," he said. "I know. It doesn't matter. Everybody trembles after an action. It's what happens during it that counts. My father told me that after Skellen Pass, he couldn't sleep without nightmares for a month."
"You're not shaking," he said.
"That's because I'm keeping busy. Would you like some more tea?"
"Yes, thanks. I thought we were going to die. And just for a moment I didn't care. It was a wonderful feeling."
He wanted to tell her how good it was to have her standing beside him, but he couldn't. He wanted to walk across the room and hold her, and knew he would not. He merely looked at her while she refilled his mug, stirring in the sugar.
"Where did you serve?" she asked, conscious of his gaze and uncertain of its meaning.
"Dros Kortswing, under Ganjavi."
"He's dead now," she said.
"Yes, a stroke. He was a fine leader. He predicted the coming war. I'm sure Abilene wishes he had listened to him."
"It wasn't only Javi who warned him," said Virai. "All the northern commanders sent reports. My father has had spies among the Nadir for years. It was obvious that they intended to attack us.
Abilene's a fool. Even now he's sending messages to Ulrik with new treaties. He won't accept that war's inevitable. Do you know we've only 10,000 men at Delnok?"
"I had heard it was less," said Rek.
"There are 6 walls and a town to defend. The complement in wartime should be 4 times as strong, and the discipline is not what it was."
"Why?"
"Because they're all waiting to die," she said, anger in her voice. "Because my father's ill, dying, and because Gan Orin has the heart of a ripe tomato."
"Orin? I've not heard of him."
"Abilene's nephew. He commands the troops, but he's useless. If I'd been a man..."
"I'm glad you're not," he said.
"Why?"
"I don't know," he said lamely. "Just something to say."
"I'm glad you're not, that's all. Anyway, if I had been a man, I would have commanded the troops. I would have done a damn sight better than Orin."
"Why are you staring at me?"
"I'm not staring, I'm listening, damn it. Why do you keep pressing me?"
"Do you want the fire lit?" she asked.
"What, are we staying that long?"
"If you want to."
"I'll leave it to you," he said.
"Let's stay for today.
That's all.
It might give us time to
get to know each other better.
We've made a pretty bad start, after all.
And you have saved my life 3 times.
"Once," he said. "I don't think you would have died of the cold. You're too tough. And Grasin saved us both. But yes, I would like to stay just for today. Mind you, I don't fancy sleeping on the floor again."
"You won't have to," she said.
The abbot smiled at the young albino's embarrassment. He released his hands from the mind hold and walked back to his desk.
"Join me, Serbitar,"
he said aloud. "Do you regret your oath of celibacy?"
"Sometimes,"
said the young man, rising from his knees. He brushed dust from his white cassock and seated himself opposite the abbot.
"The girl is worthy," Serbitar replied. "The man is an enigma. Will their force be lessened by their lovemaking?"
"Strengthened," said the abbot. "They need each other.
Together they are complete, as in the sacred book. Tell me of her.
What can I tell?
You entered her mind.
Tell me of her. She is an earl's daughter. She lacks confidence in herself as a woman, and she is a victim of mixed desires.
Why?
She doesn't know why, he hedged.
Of that I am aware. Do you know why?
No. What of the man? I did not enter his mind.
No. But what of the man?
He has great fears. He fears to die.
Is this a weakness? Asked the abbot.
It will be at Drosdelnok. Death is almost certain there.
Yes. Can it be a strength? I do not see how, said Serbitar. What does the philosopher say of cowards and heroes?
The prophet says, by nature of definition, only the coward is capable of the highest heroism.
You must convene the 30, Serbitar.
I am to lead?
Yes. You shall be the voice of the 30.
But who shall my brothers be?
The abbot leaned back in his chair. Abadak will be the heart. He is strong, fearless, and true. There could be none other. Menahem shall be the eyes, for he is gifted. I shall be the soul.
No, said the albino, it cannot be, master. I cannot lead you.
But you must. You will decide the other numbers. I shall await your decision.
Why me? Why must I lead? I should be the eyes. Abadak should lead.
Trust me. All will be revealed.
I was raised at Drosdelnok,
Virai told Rek as they lay before the blazing fire. His head rested on his rolled cloak, her head nestled on his chest. He stroked her hair, saying nothing.
It's a majestic place. Have you ever been there?
No. Tell me about it. He didn't really want to hear, but neither did he wish to speak.
It has 6 outer walls, each of them 20 feet thick. The first 3 were built by Egil, the Earl of Bronze. But then the town expanded, and gradually they built 3 more. The whole fortress spans the Delnok Pass. With the exception of Dros Perdol to the west and Kortswain to the east, it is the only route for an army to pass through the mountains. My father converted the old keep and made it his home. The view is beautiful from the upper turrets. To the south in summer, the whole of the Centrine Plain is golden with corn. And to the north you can see forever. Are you listening to me?
Yes. Golden views. You can see forever, he said softly.
Are you sure you want to hear this?
Yes.
Tell me about the walls again.
What about them?
How thick are they? They are also up to 60 feet high, with jutting towers every 50 paces. Any army attacking the Dross would suffer fearful losses.
What about the gates? He asked. The wall is only as strong as the gated shields.
The Earl of Bronze thought of that. Each gate is set behind an iron portcullis and built of layered bronze, iron, and oak. Beyond the gates are tunnels, which narrow at the center before opening out onto the level between walls. You could hold the tunnels against an enormous number of men. The whole of the Dross was beautifully designed. It's only the town which spoils it.
In what way? He said.
Originally, Egil designed the gap between the walls to be a killing ground with no cover. It was uphill to the next wall, which would slow down the enemy. With enough bowmen, you could have a massacre. It was good psychologically, too. By the time they came to take the next wall, if they ever did, they'd know there was more killing ground to come.
So how did the town spoil it?
It just grew. Now we have buildings all the way to Wall 6. The killing ground's gone. Quite the opposite, in fact. Now there's cover all the way.
He rolled over and kissed her brow.
What was that for? She asked.
Does it have to be for something?
There's a reason for everything, she said. He kissed her again.
That was for the Earl of Bronze, he said. Or the coming of spring. Or a vanished snowflake.
You don't make any sense, she told him.
Why did you let me make love to you? He asked.
What sort of a question is that?
Why?
None of your damn business, she said.
He laughed and kissed her again. Yes, my lady. Quite right. None of my business.
You're mocking me, she said, struggling to rise.
Nonsense, he said, holding her down. You're beautiful.
I'm not. I never have been. You are mocking me.
I will never mock you. And you are beautiful. And the more I look at you, the more beautiful you are.
You're a fool. Let me up.
He kissed her again, easing his body close to hers. The kiss lingered, and she returned it.
Tell me about the dross again, he said at last.
I don't want to talk about it now. You're teasing me, Rick. I won't have it. I don't want to think about it tonight, not any more. Do you believe in fate?
I do now, almost.
I'm serious. Yesterday I didn't mind about going home and facing the Nadir. I believed in the Draenei cause, and I was willing to die for it. I wasn't scared yesterday.
And today? He asked.
Today, if you asked me, I wouldn't go home.
She was lying, but she didn't know why. A surge of fear welled in her as Rek closed his eyes and leaned back.
Yes, you would, he said. You have to.
What about you?
It doesn't make sense, he said.
What doesn't?
I don't believe in what I'm feeling. I never have. I'm almost 30 years old, and I know the world.
What are you talking about?
I'm talking about fate. Destiny. An old man in tattered blue robes, without any eyes. I'm talking about love.
Love?
He opened his eyes, reached out and stroked her face.
I can't tell you what it meant to me when you stood beside me this morning. It was the highest point in my life. Nothing else mattered. I could see the sky. It was more blue than ever I've seen it. Everything was in sharp focus. I was more aware of living than I have ever been.
Does that make any sense?
No, she said gently. Not really. Do you truly think I'm beautiful?
You are the most beautiful woman who ever wore armor, he said, smiling.
That's no answer. Why am I beautiful?
Because I love you, he said, surprised at the ease with which he could say it.
Does that mean you're coming with me to Dros Delnok?
Tell me about those lovely high walls again, he said. Chapter 5. The monastery grounds were split into training areas, some of stone, some of grass, others of sand or treacherous slime-covered slate. The abbey itself stood at the centre of the grounds, a converted keep of grey stone and crenellated battlements. Four walls and a moat surrounded the abbey, the walls a later and less warlike addition of soft, golden sandstone. By the western wall, sheltered by glass and blooming out of season, were flowers of 30 different shades. All were roses. The albino Serbitar knelt before his tree, his mind at one with the plant. He had struggled for 13 years with the rose and understood it. There was empathy. There was harmony. There was fragrance that pulsed for Serbitar alone. Green fly upon the rose shriveled and died as Serbitar gazed upon them, and the soft, silky beauty of the blooms filled his senses like an opiate. It was a white rose. Serbitar sat back, eyes closed, mentally following the surge of new life within the tree. He wore full armor of silver mail shirt, sword and scabbard, leather leggings worked with silver rings. By his side was a new silver helm,
bearing the figure 1 in Elder runes. His white hair was braided, his eyes were green, the colour of the rose leaves. His slender face, translucent skin over high cheekbones, had the mystic beauty of the consumptive. He made his farewells, gently easing the gossamer panic of the plant. It had known him since its first leaf opened. And now he was to die. A smiling face grew in his mind, and Serbitar sense recognized Arbidark. "We await you," pulsed the inner message.
"I am coming," he answered.
Within the great hall a table had been set, a jug of water and a barley cake before each of 30 places. 30 men in full armor sat silently as Serbitar entered, taking his place at the head of the table and bowing to the abbot, Vintar, who now sat on his right. In silence the company ate, each thinking his own thoughts, each analyzing his emotions at this culmination of 13 years' training. Finally Serbitar spoke, fulfilling the ritual need of the order.
"Brothers, the search is upon us. We who have sought must obtain that which we seek. A messenger comes from Drosdelnok to ask us to die. What does the heart of the 30 feel on this matter?"
All eyes turned to black-bearded Arbidark. He relaxed his mind, allowing their emotions to wash over him, selecting thoughts, analyzing them, forging them into one unifying concept agreed by all. Then he spoke, his voice deep and resonant. "The heart of the matter is that the children of the Drenai face extinction. Ulrich has massed the Nadir tribes under his banner. The first attack on the Drenai Empire will be at Drosdelnok, which Earl Delnar has orders to hold until the autumn. Abelaine needs time to raise and train an army. We approach a frozen moment in the destiny of the continent. The heart says we should seek our truths at Drosdelnok." Serbitar turned to Menahem, a hawk-nosed young man, dark and swarthy, his hair braided in a single ponytail intertwined with silver thread.
"And how do the eyes of the 30 view this thing?"
"Should we go to the Dross, the city will fall," said Menahem. "Should we refuse, the city will still fall. Our presence will merely delay the inevitable. Should the messenger be worthy to ask of us our lives, then we should go." Serbitar turned to the abbot.
"Vintar, how says the soul of the 30?
The older man ran a slender hand through his thinning grey hair, then stood and bowed to Serbitar. He seemed out of place in his armor of silver and bronze. "We will be asked to kill men of another race," he said, his voice gentle, sad even. "We will be asked to kill them, not because they are evil, merely because their leaders wish to do what the Drenai themselves did 6 centuries ago. We stand between the sea and the mountains. The sea will crush us against the mountain, and thus we die. The mountain will hold us against the sea, allowing us to be crushed. Still we die. We are all weapon masters here. We seek the perfect death to counterpoint the perfect life. True, the Nadir aggression does not pose a new concept in history, but their action will cause untold horror to the Drenai people. We can say that to defend those people, we are upholding the values of our order. That our defense will fail is no reason to avoid the battle. For it is the motive that is pure, and not the outcome. Sadly, the soul says we must ride for Drosdelnok."
"So," said Serbitar, "we are agreed. I too feel strongly on this matter. We came to this temple as outcasts from the world. Shunned and feared, we came together to create the ultimate contradiction. Our bodies would become living weapons,
to polarize our minds to extremes of pacifism. Warrior priests we are, as the elders never were. There will be no joy in our hearts as we slay the enemy, for we love all life. As we die, our souls will leap forward, transcending the world's chains. All petty jealousies, intrigues, and hatreds will be left behind us as we journey to the source. The voice says, "We ride."
A three-quarter moon hung in the cloudless night sky, casting pale shadows from the trees around Rex's campfire. A luckless rabbit, gutted and encased in clay, lay on the coals as Virai came back from the stream, wiping her naked upper body with one of Rex's spare shirts. "If only you knew how much that cost me," he said, as she sat on a rock by the fire, her body glowing gold as the flames danced.
"It never served a better purpose," she said. "How much longer before that rabbit is ready?"
"Not long. You will catch your death of cold sitting half-naked in this weather. My blood's chilling to ice just watching you."
"Strange," she said. "Just this morning you were telling me how your blood ran hot just to look at me."
"That was in a warm cabin with a bed handy. I've never been much for making love in the snow. Here, I've warmed a blanket."
"When I was a child," she said, taking the blanket and wrapping it round her shoulders, "we used to have to run 3 miles across the downs in midwinter, wearing only a tunic and sandals. That was bracing. And extremely cold."
"If you're so tough, how was it that you turned blue before we found the cabin?" he asked, a broad smile rubbing the question of malice.
"The armor," she said. "Too much steel, not enough wool beneath it. Mind you, if I had been riding in front, I wouldn't have got so bored and fallen asleep. How long did you say that rabbit would be? I'm starving."
"Soon, I think." "Have you ever cooked a rabbit this way before?" she asked. "Not exactly, but it is the right way. I've seen it done. All the fur comes away as you crack the clay. It's easy." Virai was not convinced.
"I stalked that skinny beast for ages," she said, recalling with pleasure the single arrow from 40 paces which had downed it. "Not a bad bow, if a little on the light side. It's an old cavalry bow, isn't it? We have several at Delnock. The modern ones are all silver steel now. Better range and a stronger poundage. I'm starving."
"Patience aids the appetite," he told her.
"You'd better not ruin that rabbit. I don't like killing the things at the best of times, but at least there's a purpose if one can eat it."
"I'm not sure how the rabbit would respond to that line of reasoning," said Rek.
"Can they reason?" asked Virai.
"I don't know. I didn't mean it literally."
"Then why say it? You are a strange man."
"It was just an abstract thought." "Do you never have an abstract thought? Do you never wonder how a flower knows when it's time to grow, or how the salmon finds its way back to the spawning grounds?"
"No," she said. "Is the rabbit cooked?"
"Well, what do you think about when you're not planning how to kill people?"
"Eating," she said. "What about that rabbit?"
Rek tipped the ball of clay from the coals with a stick, watching it sizzle on the snow.
"Well, what do you do now?" she asked.
He ignored her and picked up a fist-sized rock, then cracked it hard against the clay, which split, to disgorge a half-cooked, half-skinned rabbit.
"Looks good," she said. "What now?"
He poked the steaming meat with a stick. "Can you face eating that?" he said.
"Of course. Can I borrow your knife? Which bit do you want?"
"I've got some oatcake left in my pack. I think I'll make do with that. Will you put some clothes on?" They were camped in a shallow depression under a rock face, not deep enough to be a cave, but large enough to reflect heat from the fire and cut out the worst of the wind. Rek chewed his oatcake and watched the girl devour the rabbit. It was not an edifying sight. She hurled the remnants of the carcass into the trees.
"Badgers should enjoy it," she said. "That's not a bad way to cook rabbit."
"I'm glad you enjoyed it," he said.
"You're not much of a woodsman, are you?" she told him.
"I manage."
"You couldn't even gut the thing. You look green when the entrails popped out."
Rek hurled the rest of his oatcake in the direction of the hapless rabbit. "The badgers will probably appreciate dessert," he said. Virai giggled happily.
"You're wonderful, Rek. You're unlike any man I ever met."
"I don't think I'm going to like what's coming next," he said. "Why don't we just go to sleep?"
"No. Listen to me. I'm serious. All my life I have dreamt of finding the right man. Tall, kind, strong, understanding, loving. I never thought he existed. Most of the men I've known have been soldiers, gruff, straight as spears, and as romantic as a bull in heat. And I've met poets, soft of speech and gentle. When I was with soldiers, I longed for poets, and when with poets, I longed for soldiers. I had begun to believe the man I wanted could not exist. Do you understand me?"
"All your life you've been looking for a man who couldn't cook rabbits. Of course I understand you."
"Do you really?" she asked softly.
"Yes, but explain it to me anyway."
"You're what I've always wanted," she said, blushing. "You're my coward hero, my love."
"I knew there would be something I wouldn't like," he said. As she placed some logs on the blaze, he held out his hand.
"Sit beside me," he said. "You'll be warmer." "You can share my blanket," she told him, moving round the fire and into his arms, resting her head on his shoulder. "You don't mind if I call you my coward hero?"
"You can call me what you like," he said, "so long as you're always there to call me."
"Always?"
The wind tilted the flames and he shivered. "Always isn't such a long time for us, is it? We only have as much time as Drostelnok holds. Anyway, you might get tired of me and send me away."
"Never," she said.
"Never and always. I had not thought about those words much until now. Why didn't I meet you 10 years ago? The words might have meant something then."
"I doubt it. I would only have been 9 years old.
I didn't mean it literally. Poetically."
"My father has written to Dras," she said. "That letter and this mission are all that keep him alive."
"Dras? But even if he's alive, he will be ancient by now. He will be obscene. Skeln was 15 years ago and he was old then. They will have to carry him into the Dras."
"Perhaps. But my father sets great store by the man. He was awed by him. He feels he's invincible, immortal. He once described him to me as the greatest warrior of the age. He said Skeln Pass was Druss's victory, and that he and the others just made up the numbers. He used to tell that story to me when I was young. We would sit by a fire, like this, and toast bread on the flames. Then he'd tell me about Skeln. Marvellous days."
She lapsed into silence, staring into the coals. "Tell me the story," he said, drawing her closer to him, his right hand pushing back the hair that had fallen across her face.
"You must know it. Everyone knows about Skeln."
"True, but I've never heard the story from someone who was there. I've only seen the plays and listened to the saga poets."
"Tell me what you heard, and I will fill in the detail."
"All right. There were a few hundred Drenai warriors holding Skeln Pass, while the main Drenai army massed elsewhere. It was the Ventrian king, Gorbin, they were worried about. They knew he was on the march, but not where he would strike. He struck at Skeln. They were outnumbered 50-1, and they held on until reinforcements arrived. That's all."
"Not quite," said Virai. "Gorbin had an inner army of 10,000 men called the Immortals. They had never been beaten, but Dras beat them."
"Oh, come," said Rek. "One man cannot beat an army. That saga poet stuff."
"No, listen to me. My father said that on the last day, when the Immortals were finally sent in, the Drenai line had begun to fold. My father has been a warrior all his life. He understands battles and the shift and flow between courage and panic. The Drenai were ready to crack. But then, just as the line was beginning to give, Dras bellowed a battle cry and advanced, cutting and slashing with his axe. The Ventrians fell back before him. And then suddenly, those nearest to him turned to run. The panic spread like brush fire, and the entire Ventrian line crumbled. Druss had turned the tide. My father says he was like a giant that day, inhuman, like a god of war.
That was then, said Rek. I can't see a toothless old man being of much use. No man can resist age.
I agree, but can you see what a boost to morale it will be just to have Druss there? Men will flock to the banner. To fight a battle alongside Druss the legend, there's an immortality to it.
Have you ever met the old man? Asked Rek.
No, my father would never tell me, but there was something between them. Druss would never come to Drostelnok. It was something to do with my mother, I think.
She didn't like him?
No, something to do with a friend of Druss. Sieben, I think he was called.
What happened to him?
He was killed at Skiln. He was Druss's oldest friend. That's all I know about it.
Rek knew she was lying, but let it rest. It was all ancient history, anyway. Like Druss the legend. The old man crumpled the letter and let it fall. It was not age which depressed Druss. He enjoyed the wisdom of his 60 years, the knowledge accrued, and the respect it earned. But the physical ravages of time were another thing altogether. His shoulders were still mighty above a barrel chest, but the muscles had taken on a stretched look, wiry lines which crisscrossed his upper back. His waist, too, had thickened perceptibly over the last winter, and almost overnight he realized his black beard streaked with grey had become a grey beard streaked with black. But the piercing eyes which gazed at their reflection in the silver mirror had not dimmed. Their stare had dismayed armies, caused heroic opponents to take a backward step, blushing and shamed, caught the imagination of a people who had needed heroes. He was Druss the legend, invincible Druss, captain of the axe. The legends of his life were told to children everywhere, and most of them were legends, Druss reflected. Druss the hero, immortal, godlike. His past victories could have ensured him a palace of riches, concubines by the score. 15 years before, Abelaine himself had showered him with jewels following his exploits at the Skeln Pass. By the following morning, however, Druss had gone back to the Skoda Mountains, high into the lonely country bordering the clouds. Among the pine and the snow leopards, the grizzled old warrior had returned to his lair to taste again of solitude. His wife of 30 years lay buried there. He had a mind to die there, though there would be no one to bury him, he knew. During the past 15 years, Druss had not been inactive. He had wandered various lands, leading battle companies for minor princelings. Last winter he had retired to his high mountain retreat, there to think and die. He had long known he would die in his 60th year, even before the seer's prediction all those decades ago. He had been able to picture himself at 60, but never beyond. Whenever he tried to consider the prospects of being 61, he would experience only darkness. His gnarled hands curled round a wooden goblet and raised it to his grey-bearded lips. The wine was strong, brewed himself 5 years before. It had aged well, better than he. But it was gone, and he remained for a little while. The heat within his sparse, furnished cabin was growing oppressive as the new spring sun warmed the wooden roof. Slowly he removed the sheepskin jacket he had worn all winter and the undervest of horsehair. His massive body, crisscrossed with scars, belied his age. He studied the scars, remembering clearly the men whose blades had caused them. Men who would never grow old, as he had. Men who had died in their prime beneath his singing axe. His blue eyes flicked to the wall by the small wooden door. There she hung, Snaga, which in the old tongue meant the sender. Slim haft of black steel, interwoven with eldritch runes in silver thread,
and a double-edged blade so shaped that it sang as it slew. Even now he could hear its sweet song. "One last time, soul brother," it called to him. "One last bloody day before the sun sets." His mind returned to Delnar's letter. It was written to the memory, and not the man. Druss raised himself from the wooden chair, cursing as his joints creaked. "The sun has set," whispered the old warrior, addressing the axe. "Now only death waits, and he's a patient bastard." He walked from the cabin, gazing out over the distant mountains. His massive frame and grey-black hair mirrored in miniature the mountains he surveyed. Proud, strong, ageless, and snow-topped, they defied the spring sun as it strove to deny them their winter peaks of virgin snow. Druss soaked in their savage splendour, sucking in the cool breeze and tasting life as if for the last time. "Where are you, Death?" he called. "Where do you hide on this fine day?" The echoes boomed around the valleys. "Death, death, 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 day, 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 day. I am Druss, and I defy you." A shadow fell across Druss's eyes. The sun died in the heavens, and the mountains receded into mist. Pain clamped Druss's mighty chest, soul deep, and he almost fell. "Proud mortal," hissed a sibilant voice through the veils of agony. "I never sought you. You have hunted me through these long, lonely years. Stay on this mountain, and I guarantee you 20 more years. Your muscles will atrophy. Your brain will sink into dotage. You will bloat, old man, and I will only come when you beg it. Or will the huntsman have one more hunt? Seek me if you will, old warrior. I stand on the walls of Druss Delnok." The pain lifted from the old man's heart. He staggered once, drew soothing mountain air into his burning lungs, and gazed about him. Birds still sang in the pine. No clouds obscured the sun, and the mountains stood tall and proud, as they always had done. Druss returned to the cabin and went to a chest of oak padlocked at the onset of winter. The key lay deep in the valley below. He placed his giant hands about the lock and began to exert pressure. Muscles writhed on his arms, veins bulged on his neck and shoulders, and the metal groaned, changed shape, and split. Druss threw the padlock aside and opened the chest. Within lay a jerkin of black leather, the shoulders covered in a skin of shining steel, and a black leather skullcap, only relieved by a silver axe flanked by silver skulls. Long black leather gauntlets came into view, silver-skinned to the knuckles. Swiftly he dressed, coming finally to the long leather boots, a present from Abelain himself so many years before. Lastly he reached for Snaga, which seemed to leap from the wall to his waiting hand. "One last time, soul brother," he told it, "before the sun sets." Chapter 6. With Vintar standing beside him, Serbitar watched from a high balcony as the two riders approached the monastery, cantering their horses towards the northern gate. Grass showed in patches on the snow-covered fields as a warm spring wind eased in from the west.
"Not a time for lovers," said Serbitar aloud.
"It is always a time for lovers, my son. In war, most of all," said Vintar. "Have you probed the man's mind?" "Yes, he is a strange one. A cynic by experience, a romantic by inclination, and now a hero by necessity."
"How will Menahem test the messenger?" asked Vintar.
"With fear," answered the albino.
Rack was feeling good. The air he breathed was crisp and clean, and a warm westerly breeze promised an end to the harshest winter in years. The woman he loved was beside him, and the sky was blue and clear.
"What a great day to be alive," he said.
"What's so special about today?" asked Virai.
"It's beautiful. Can't you taste it? The sky, the breeze, the melting snow."
"Someone is coming to meet us. He looks like a warrior," she said.
The rider approached them and dismounted. His face was covered by a black and silver helm, crowned with a horsehair plume. Rek and Virai dismounted and approached him.
"Good morning," said Rek.
The man ignored him. His dark eyes, seen through the slits in the helm, focused on Virai.
"You are the messenger?"
he asked her.
"I am. I wish to see Abbot Vintar."
"First you must pass me," he said, stepping back and drawing a long sword of silver steel.
"Wait a moment," said Rek. "What is this? One does not normally have to fight one's way into a monastery."
Once again the man ignored him, and Virai drew her rapier.
"Stop it," ordered Rek. "This is insane."
"Stay out of this, Rek," said Virai. "I will slice this silver beetle into tiny pieces."
"No, you won't," he said, gripping her arm. "That rapier is no good against an armored man. In any case, the whole thing is senseless. You are not here to fight anybody. You simply have a message to deliver, that's all. There must be a mistake somewhere. Wait a moment."
Rek walked towards the warrior, his mind racing, his eyes checking for weak points in the armored defenses. The man wore a molded breastplate over a mail shirt of silver steel. Protecting his neck was a silver torque. His legs were covered to the thigh in leather trews, cased with silver rings, and upon his shins were leather greaves. Only the man's knees, hands, and chin were open to attack.
"Will you tell me what is happening?" Rek asked him. "I think you may have the wrong messenger. We are here to see the abbot."
"Are you ready, woman?" asked Menahem.
"Yes," said Virai, her rapier cutting a figure eight in the morning air as she loosened her wrist.
Rek's blade flashed into his hand.
"Defend yourself," he cried. "No, Rek, he's mine," shouted Virai. "I don't need you to fight for me. Step aside."
"You could have him next," said Rek. He turned his attention back to Menahem.
"Come on, then. Let's see if you fight as prettily as you look."
Menahem turned his dark eyes on the tall figure before him. Instantly, Rek's stomach turned over. This was death. Cold, final, worm in the eye sockets, death. There was no hope in this contest. Panic welled in Rek's breast, and his limbs began to tremble. He was a child again, locked in a darkened room, knowing the demons were hiding in the black shadows. Fear in the shape of bile rose in his throat as nausea shook him. He wanted to run. He needed to run. Instead, Rek screamed and launched an attack, his blade whistling towards the black and silver helm. Startled, Menahem hastily parried, and a second blow almost got through. The warrior stepped backwards, desperately trying to regain the initiative, but Rek's furious assault had caught him off balance. Menahem parried and moved, trying to circle. Virai watched in stunned silence as Rek's blistering assault continued. The two men's swords glittered in the morning sunlight, a dazzling web of white light, a stunning display of skill. Virai felt a surge of pride. She wanted to cheer Rek on, but resisted the urge, knowing the slightest distraction could sway the contest.
"Help me," pulsed Menahem to Serbitar, "or I may have to kill him."
He parried a blow, catching it only inches from his throat.
"If I can," he added.
"How can we stop it?" Serbitar asked Vintar. "The man is a bearsark. I cannot get through to him. He will kill Menahem before much longer." "The girl," said Vintar,
join with me?"
Virai shivered as she watched Rek growing in strength. Bearsark! Her father had told her of such men, but never would she have placed Rek in their company. They were mad killers who lost all sense of reason and fear in combat, becoming the most deadly of opponents. All swordsmen gravitate between defense and attack, for despite a desire to win, there is an equal desire not to lose. But the Bearsark loses all fear. His is all-out attack, and invariably he takes his opponent with him, even if he falls. A thought struck her powerfully, and suddenly she knew that the warrior was not trying to kill Rek. The contest was but a test.
"Put up your swords!" she screamed. "Stop it!"
The two men battled on.
"Rek, listen to me!" she shouted. "It's only a test! He's not trying to kill you!"
Her voice came to Rek as from a great distance, piercing the red mist before his eyes. Stepping back, he felt, rather than saw, the relief in the other man. Then he took a deep breath and relaxed, his legs shaky, his hands trembling.
"You entered my mind," he accused the warrior, fixing the man's dark eyes in a cold gaze. "I don't know how, but if you ever do it again, I will kill you. Do you understand me?"
"I understand," Menahem told him softly, his voice muffled within his helm. Rek sheathed his blade at the second attempt and turned to Virai, who was looking at him strangely.
"It wasn't really me," he said. "Don't look at me like that, Virai."
"Oh, Rek, I'm sorry," she said, tears in her eyes. "I'm truly sorry."
A new kind of fear hit him as she turned her face away.
"Don't leave me," he said. "It rarely happens, and I would never turn on you. Never. Believe me."
She turned to face him, throwing her arms about his neck.
"Leave you? What are you talking about? It doesn't matter to me, you fool. I was just sorry for you. Oh, Rek, you're such an idiot. I'm not some tavern girl who squeals at the sight of a rat. I'm a woman who has grown up alongside men, soldiers, fighting men, warriors. You think I would leave you because you are Bearsark?"
"I can control it," he said, holding her tightly to him.
"Where we are going, Rek, you will not have to," she said.
Serbitar left the monastery balcony and poured a goblet of spring water from a stone jug.
"How did he do it?"
Vintar sat back on a leather chair.
"There is a well of courage within him, fueled by many things, of which we can only guess. But when Menahem fed him fear, he responded with violence. Because what Menahem could not have understood is that the man fears fear itself. Did you glimpse that memory of his childhood during Menahem's probe?"
"The tunnels, you mean?"
"Yes. What do you make of a child who fears the dark and yet seeks out dark tunnels to travel through?"
"He tried to end his fears by facing them," said Serbitar.
"He still does. And that's why Menahem almost died."
"He will be useful at Drostelnok," said Serbitar, smiling.
"More than you know," said Vintar. "More than you know."
"Yes," Serbitar told Rek as they sat within the oak-panelled study overlooking the courtyard.
"Yes, we can read minds. But I assure you we will not again attempt to read yours, or that of your companion."
"Why did he do that to me?" asked Rek.
"Menahem is the eyes of the 30. He had to see that you were worthy to ask of us the service. You expect us to fight with your forces, to analyze enemy tactics, and to use our skills in defense of a fortress about which we care nothing. The messenger has to be worthy."
"But I am not the messenger. I am merely a companion."
"We shall see. How long have you known of your affliction?"
Rek turned his gaze to the window and the balcony beyond. A wren landed on the railing, sharpened his beak on the stone, and then flew off. Light clouds were forming, fleece islands in the clear blue of the sky. It has happened only twice, both times in the Setulia Wars, once when we were surrounded after a dawn raid on a village, and the second time when I was part of a guard unit on a spices caravan.
It is common among warriors, said Serbitar. It is a gift of fear.
It saved my life both times, but it scares me, said Rek. It is as if someone else takes over my mind and body.
But that is not so, I assure you. It is you alone. Do not fear what you are, Rek. May I call you Rek?
Of course. I did not wish to be overly familiar.
It is a nickname, is it not?
A shortened form of Regnak. My foster father Horeb shortened it when I was a child. It was a kind of joke. I disliked robust games and never wanted to explore or climb high trees. I wasn't reckless, he said. So he dropped the less and he called me Rek. As I said, it's not much of a joke, but the name stuck.
Do you think